on shortwave, satellite, and the internet. This is Media Network Plus.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to the program. On Sunday, July 10th, 2016, at his house in Merritt Island, Florida, longtime Radio Netherlands contributor Lou Josephs, he contributed to the Media Network program, passed away at age 65. Lou Josephs was not just a contributor for Radio Netherlands Media Network, but also worked at a variety of stations in the United States. Jonathan Marks prepared this little retrospective of Lou Josephs.
Lou was always the go-to guy when it came to finding out what was going on, for example, the development of the internet or anything to do with radio. And as the world brought in the new year across the Pacific, Asia, Europe and the States, Lou used to compile these fascinating lists and audio clips for us so we could hear how the world was celebrating a new beginning. And this is all decades before Facebook and Twitter. And listening back to the old shows in the last few days, I counted over, must be, 250 contributions in one form or another, not to mention the emails and phone calls that we had in between. We came up with crazy one-liners for the show. Lou voiced many of them, and he also gave me tips which no one else knew, mainly about clandestine broadcasting, or things he'd heard while scanning the bands, or through his incredible network of people he knew. I'd also like to add love and best wishes from Andy Sennett, Diana Jonser, Victor Gunatilica, Richard Cuff, John Filigliotti, Bob Horowitz, Kim Andrew Elliott, and Thomas Witherspoon. Just some of the people who've contacted me actually in the last couple of hours and asked to be remembered to you. I'll always recall the crazy times when Lou and Susan helped me after the Dayton Hamvention. I flew into Logan Airport on useless air, as Lou would call it, and there was Lou to meet me at the gate. He told me to get in the car, and we deliberately drove the wrong way round Logan Airport so I could get to the northwest gate on the other side of the place just in time, and I made it with seconds to spare, and I remember my luggage arrived 3 days later. But like Jim, my highlights will be sitting in the car at Scituate, Massachusetts, on the beach, looking at the old transmitter site of WRUL, later WNYW, with Lou giving me the tour of the radio station where he'd worked as a kid, and which fueled, I think, his love for radio, and also space. It's been an honour and a pleasure to be part of that amazing journey. So long, mate.
Hello from Moscow. Lou showed up one day in the form of a letter that he wrote to Radio Moscow World Service in the late 80s, where I was doing a weekly pop music request show for listeners around the world. He heard the show as he was an avid shortwave radio listener and commented on it. And I guess I said hi to him on the show. I wrote back and he wrote back and I wrote back and we became friends. He sent in a lot of production, very clever production work, very creative production work, various bits that he came up with and that I used in my show. And he was very helpful, especially later on when I left Radio Moscow World Service and joined one of the first commercial radio stations to go up in Moscow. This was a joint Russian-American venture called Radio 7 Moscow. I was a program director, not only the morning show host, but the program director. And for me, I didn't know what I was getting into. So I had a lot of questions that I addressed to Lou. And he was always ready to suggest one thing, to talk about something else, how to improve the show, you know. And he was always part of the show. We used his voice a lot. This was before the age of the internet, before the emails. So we would, most of the time we would exchange faxes. And not only faxes, would you believe it? There was a time when we both worked on the air at the same time, only on two different continents. What we would do sometimes we would call each other up. We would call the, I would call the Boston area control room of the radio station he was working, and he would pick up the phone, or he would call me in Moscow, and we would talk for hours. He would say, hold on a second, I got to do a segue or something. Or I would say, hold on a sec, I got to do this. And, you know, he would hear me doing it and say, hey, that was nice, you know, but you can try this or that. You know, you, I remember Lou taught me about the importance of quote unquote forward momentum. He would advise me on the music to play, songs to avoid. He was very, very helpful. And he was just very passionate about radio. He was crazy about radio, and he was very talented, very talented. One of the biggest professional highlights in my career was when I met Lou in 1991. And not only Lou, but Jonathan Marks of Radio Nederland. I could never pronounce that correctly. We spent some time together in Boston, and we went to a Boston area DX meeting or something, had a lot of pizza, overdosed on cola, and I spent unforgettable nights sleeping in a sleeping bag on the floor of Lou's little house. He later took me to a Star Trek convention, which was a lot of fun. He was a science fiction fanatic. Yeah, we had some great times together, for which I'm very, very thankful.
Of course I can hear you, Jonathan.
Hi, Lou.
Where are you?
I'm on Interstate 95, just outside the Philadelphia airport.
On your way to Cubsville, we understand.
Yes, heading eastbound, as a matter of fact.
So you're zooming along at the moment?
In spite of a nasty kind of overcast day. Picked up a lot of rain in the Washington, Baltimore area, but nothing up here yet.
Are you
that's expected later.
Are you available to talk to us, or is it a bit dangerous?
It was when I heard the phone ring earlier as I was rounding Wilmington, Delaware, but not a problem now.
Wilmington, Delaware, the home of DuPont, if I remember rightly.
Yeah, and just about every major bank in the United States has got some kind of credit card operation there as well.
Lou, you started very much in the radio business, and now you're very much into the internet business. I mean, you still listen to shortwave radio?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I listened to it a couple of nights ago when Victor had indicated that, as well as Tom, had indicated that there was some substantial Asian openings from the East Coast of North America out to Asia.
Now, you did a lot of work in the past programming radio stations. What's American radio like these days?
Funny you should mention that. This is a nostalgia, a welcome back after 20 years trip into Philadelphia, because I used to program a radio station in Philadelphia, which was an AM radio station, which I had a chance to listen to just briefly a while ago, and it's all religion all the time.
So, I mean, is American radio getting too homogenized? Homogenized, rather?
I think so. In a lot of respects, it's very different than it used to be. You have a lot of major group owners who own most of the radio properties, and then you have very few small entrepreneurs left.
And what about the internet radio side? I mean, that's what Deanna and I are very interested in. Far away.
Yes. Okay. How are they doing, Lou? The internet only stations, are they growing as fast as we get the impression they are doing right here?
They're trying, but the actual growth of internet-only radio, again, comes down to if you program it correctly, they'll come. And it comes down to your promotion. It comes down to the quality of music that you play. It comes down to the technical capabilities of the radio station and how you stream it.
That's interesting. I was in a discussion about 2 days ago where there was a sort of a big debate between the traditional broadcasters, people like the NOS, for instance, in this country, and also the internet boys and girls, the new media, people just starting up cable. And one huge cable company here in Amsterdam, the UPC company, just bought a television station as well. And one of the guys from that new media operation said, oh, you know, the programmers are just about finished because everybody's going to go out with their own cameras and make their own broadcasts. And this is complete rubbish, isn't it?
Yeah, from a standpoint of making your own broadcast with your own camera, yeah. I brought a laptop with me to the Fest at Cobsville today, basically so I could get some fast and dirty video and photographs of some of the people that are going to be here today. But from a standpoint of could I post that on the web? Yeah, I could, but it's not going to look very good.
How fast is broadband doing?
Broadband is creeping along slowly, and that's to be very nice about it. Cable operators, their major problem is creating an infrastructure. A lot of the cable companies have done what radio has done as well, and one cable company that used to be the locally owned cable company or was owned by a small cable company has now been engulfed and devoured by a larger cable company. What that means is that the plans for upgrading to fiber optic capability, which gives you really good broadband, hasn't happened in a lot of major markets and even in a lot of the smaller markets in the United States. Meanwhile, DSL, digital subscriber line, which is basically your regular copper telephone line that we're talking on now, being used as a high-speed internet access. That's happening very, very slowly. Part of that has to do with the complexities of putting that kind of equipment in the local telephone company offices.
Okay. When we talk about audiences, Lou, people using the service, how do we measure how many people use the services?
That is a very interesting topic to get into because we're talking about, at this point, only Arbitron measuring a select group of radio station webcasters. And Nielsen is supposed to be entering the fray to measure shortly, but that hasn't happened yet. But the Arbitron data is interesting because you can mathematically rip it apart so that if you wanted to be the number one webcaster on your block, you can.
And are a lot of people listening? Because we, for example, see these big webcasts in the pop concerts. I think there was one earlier this year, wasn't there?
Yeah, Paul McCartney.
That's right. But, I mean, that crashed as soon as it started, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. It crashed within 5 minutes after it began because they hadn't really brought things to the edge of the network to make it possible to listen to. And by edge of the network, I mean making sure that the servers were local to the people who were going to use the webcast or listen to it. For example, if you were to do a very large scale webcast like that again, you'd want to be able to have that with varying technical elements all over the world rather than just in a couple of different locations.
Okay, now you're heading towards Kelmville. How long have you got before you get there?
I'm in Swarthmore, Pennsylvania now, which is, if you remember anything about the Mamas and the Papas, there's a line about Cass going to Swarthmore, and we're going right past that right now. And you may remember in early radio history in the United States something called the Media Pennsylvania decision, and I'm going right through Media Pennsylvania at the moment.
Well, Media Pennsylvania on Media Network, brilliant. Well done. Thank you very much indeed for getting in touch and safe journey. And maybe we'll talk to you a little later on.
Bye, Lou.
I hope so.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
It's extremely difficult to set up a new radio station in the United States at the moment. The banks are loath to lend money out. And as Lou Josephs has been explaining to me, a change in the law is having a profound effect on the broadcast industry. A couple of weeks back, 4,000 people attended the National Association of Broadcasters Radio Programmers meeting in New Orleans. Those like Lou who wandered round the meeting discovered that the radio people had almost deserted the convention. The main discussions were between lawyers and financiers interested in buying up radio stations.
Well, the FCC in its wit and wisdom have changed the rules. Now group owners are allowed to own up to 2 AMs and 2 FMs in the same market. What that means is, a lot like European networks, we're now beginning to see the beginning of regional networks in the United States. For example, we now have the Boston Radio Group, which consists of radio stations WXKS-FM, WXKS-AM, WBMX-FM, WHDH-AM, and WRKO-AM, all owned by one owner.
And that one owner can control up to 25% of a given audience share in any market. So, rather than having a lot of small stations, many new owners plan to combine resources in the areas of sales and management. And with the increasing use of digital technology, such as digital storage devices linked to a sophisticated timer, it's possible for a handful of on-air presenters to drive several stations at once. So, what will all this mean to the industry as a whole?
Radio by its very nature in the United States is a narrow cast medium. What I think it's basically going to mean is that the strong will survive.
In order to stand out from the rest, increasing use is made of what's called direct marketing. First, the radio station needs the names and addresses of its listeners.
If you receive on target, that means you're on Radio Netherlands' database. That's how a radio station creates a database. They know who their listeners are, and they're able to send them things from time to time.
But whereas we keep that mailing list purely for our own use, commercial radio stations are happy to sell the data to others. It's common practice. In Holland, for instance, one of the biggest sources of specialized names and addresses is the PTT.
Anytime you make a credit card purchase, anytime you make a purchase in the supermarket, it's scanned. Anytime you make a long-distance telephone call, that information is contained in a file. Anytime you go have a medical test run, that information is contained in a file.
And it's quite amazing how that data is then used by the radio stations to sell advertising time.
There's information available in one project that I've been working on in Houston, for example. I can tell you who listens to this particular radio station right down to the block group they live on.
Do you know a profile about these people? You know,
What kind of television shows they watch. I know what things they consume. I know what kind of car they drive. Say, for example, we were whiz-bang radios, and we had this new super radio that we wanted to sell to shortwave listeners. Well, I could go find a database that would tell me where to find all the shortwave listeners in the United States, and then I could send them a little brochure about my whiz-bang radio and where to buy it.
Talking of whiz-bang radios, one of them was on a show at the NAB. You mentioned super radio. That's what it's called.
Yes, the NAB long-awaited FM-AM stereo AMAX Super Radio debuted. It's the most expensive piece of garbage I've ever seen.
Really? That's an interesting way of summing it up. How much does it cost?
It costs $499, but Jonathan, that's just the tuner. That doesn't include speakers or an amplifier or a loop antenna.
A loop antenna? That looks like something you might construct yourself?
Yeah, and if you don't feel like constructing it yourself, you can pay Denon $17.99 for one.
The Denon TU680 NAB doesn't have a band switch. As soon as you get to the top end of the medium wave band, it switches to FM automatically. Mind you, there's a noticeable audio quality difference. But wasn't the FCC planning to extend the medium wave band to reduce the interference problems?
Yeah, they're getting ready to do just that. They're going to be soon authorizing stations to operate from 1610 right through to 1710. Things they're looking at are interference with the fisheries beacons that are out there in the Atlantic and in the Gulf of Mexico and in the Pacific Ocean. And they're also taking a look at what kind of other interference might develop in that band before they actually start authorizing stations to be there. It should be another month or so before they finally have the actual applications process all set and ready to go.
But at the moment, nobody's up there. I'm above 1610.
Not yet. There are some experimental stations that show up there from time to time. And as a matter of fact, the digital audio broadcasting demonstration occurred on 1660.
Delegates to the NAB convention heard an interesting experimental digital broadcast from WNOE in New Orleans. On 1060 kilohertz, the station was audible in AMAX AM stereo as usual. But a 4-watt transmitter on 1660 kilohertz was also active. On an ordinary radio, the stream of digital data at 126 kilobits per second sounds just like a shh noise. But the test radio was able to get a superb stereo radio signal out of it.
The Acorn in-band DAB system was probably the most ignored aspect of this particular NAB, but the one with the most far-reaching consequences, because AM sounded as good as FM.
So engineers behind the USA Digital Radio Project have succeeded in broadcasting programs in digital form and squeezing that data stream into a 10 kilohertz bandwidth. Will it work on shortwave? Will it breathe new life into AM? More on that topic next week. Meanwhile, a fax has arrived from Bob German, project manager at the new shortwave station WEWN in Birmingham, Alabama. He reports that their first shortwave transmitter arrived on Monday, and they expect to be testing a month from now with a few antenna tests in 3 weeks' time. More on that when we have it.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, but I know we'll sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
You're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. I just want to remind you, before we get to this week's propagation, about the special program that we have coming up on the 21st and 22nd of August. It's our continuing series from the Radio Netherlands Archives, Program 2. The transmission schedule is as followed. August 21st from 6 to 8 hours UTC, and that's actually going to be broadcast to Europe on 7780 kHz. That's morning hours in Europe on August 21st. And then on August 22nd, also UTC time, from 1 to 3 hours UTC on 7570, which is the Sunday evening. And the program is presented by Paulette McQuarrie. So do go and check it out. And we are going to be issuing a different EQSL from the first one that we did. Anyway, you are listening, like I said, to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. It's now time to turn our attention to propagation, what's been happening, and what we can expect. Here's Glenn Hauser.
Keith from IPS in Australia, the global HF propagation forecast, normal at all latitudes on August 19th, normal to fair on August 20th. From Space Weather South Africa through August 20th, magnetic conditions unsettled, shortwave fadeouts unlikely, MUF unstable. From Met Office UK through August 21st, solar activity low or very low, geomagnetic field possible active spells August 20th and 21st. OK1MGW of the Czech Propagation Interested Group says the geomagnetic field will be quiet to unsettled on August 19th, 23rd, 31st, September 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and 6th. Quiet to active on August 20th. 21st, 24th, 25th, 28th to 30th, September 4th and 5th. Mostly quiet on August 22nd. Quiet on August 26th and 27th. Active to disturb August 29th and 30th. From Space Weather Canada, the long-term magnetic activity forecast in the auroral and polar zones, high DRX readings August 24th and 25th, and even higher on August 30th. From the Space Weather Prediction Center in Boulder, Geomagnetic field expected to be at G1 minor storm levels August 30th and 31st, with ANK indices peaking at 25 and 5. Unsettled to active levels expected August 24th and 25th and September 1st to 8th, reaching 15 and 4. Lowest A's and K's of 5 and 2 on August 21st to 23rd and 26th to 28th, and not again until September 9th and 10th. Solar flux dropping from 90 August 18th to 75 from August 22nd to September 1st, up to 90 again by September 4th. William Hepburn's VHF, UHF, microwave DX maps show extreme tropospheric ducting all week off Southern California and Baja California Norte, along the north coast of the Greater Antilles all week, moving westward into Cuba by August 23rd, all week off the northwest coast of Africa, all week across the eastern Mediterranean, and part of the week over central and western Mediterranean, all week across the Red Sea, southern Caspian Sea, Persian Gulf, Arabian Sea along the coasts of Iran and Pakistan, and off the coast of Angola through August 21st.
Thanks, Glenn. And if you'd like to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, have any story ideas or suggestions, our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com, mnp@pcjmedia.com. Also, let us know how you heard the program. So until next time, friends, I'm Keith Parent wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you in 7 days. 73 and 88 to the ladies.